Tonight on Arena, a Nollaig na mBan event at Whelan's, Turner at the National Gallery, and Alva Reddy performs live for us in studio. Very welcome along to the very first Arena of 2026. I'm Rick O'Shea. We're here with you for an hour until 8 o'clock tonight. You can text us on 51551 as usual. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32 and you can email arena@rte.ie. To start tonight, singer-songwriter Alva Reddy has spent the last few years becoming one of the most vital voices in Irish indie rock. From the soul-bearing honesty of her debut Personal History to the high-energy reflection of her second album Endless Affair, she's honed her rare gift for turning the messy private details of life into something beautiful. Fresh off a short tour on the east coast of the United States, she is back with a new brand new album called Kiss Big, which will be released on a new label at the end of this month. She's headlining a solo gig at the Button Factory on the 8th of May, but she's here with us first. Our very first guest of the year, Alva Reddy, welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the third album. Personal History is 2020 and then Endless Affair is 2023. Kiss Big is at the end of the month. How does it feel to be on album number three, just to begin with?
Kind of wild. I was talking to someone earlier about it and they were saying, that's so many albums for such a short period, but it doesn't feel that way to me. It just feels like a natural progression. It always feels like you've been working on it for ages by the time it comes out.
And have you? What was the creation of this album like over time?
It happened while I was touring the last album. I was kind of writing bits and pieces while driving around America or the UK or Ireland or wherever else. Between that and then I moved to London in 2022 and kind of starting out a new little life there. And I have a lot of memories of writing songs from this album during like a heat wave in my first summer there. So yeah, it feels like a really natural progression from the last one.
Are you the sort of songwriter who needs to let songs sit for a little while before you end up recording them, or let them hear them live before you end up recording them?
It's really nice to hear them live. Actually, the title track, Kiss Big, was a song I didn't think would make it on the album. And I was playing a show in Paris at the end of 2023 and there was something wrong with the keyboard. So I kind of thought, I'll just throw this one that I'm working on in. I kind of thinking it was a little cute little joke song and people really responded to it. So I kind of said, maybe this should be on the album, and it ended up being one of the centerpieces of it in the end.
That's a really nice serendipity to have.
Totally.
You've mentioned that Kiss Big explores the aftershock of a breakup, that kind of space where you're equal parts sad or hopeful or delusional. How did you find the balance between all of those conflicting emotions when you were writing?
It's this thing that happens where you write all these songs and then when you start recording them, even demoing them, you realize that there's a natural chronological storyline. Like the way that the album has ended up being is almost chronological. Like the way the first song is the first song I wrote for it, second song is the second song I wrote for it. It ended up being like that obvious that there was this very obvious storyline that kind of came from going through a massive breakup, deciding you're never going to love again, and then finding yourself back in the same spot, that kind of cyclical nature of like love and hope and optimism.
You've described the album as a cycle of endings and a cycle of beginnings. So after the kind of slightly party atmosphere of Endless Affair, so what brought you to this kind of messy middle ground that you know, some of this album finds itself in? Why this? Why here? Why now?
I suppose just going through a big breakup, moving away, traveling a lot, kind of having that turning 30 and having that rebirth, it just became this thing that I kept coming back to. And the fact that we are also hopeful when it comes to romantic love, I think. Everybody goes through a big thing and says, I'm never doing that again. And then they find themselves back to the start again. And I found with the songs that by the end of the album, they were turning kind of more romantic and hopeful, while at the beginning, they were kind of more somber.
Well, let's hear something from the album. You're going to play the new single, which is out tomorrow, as I understand it. This is That Girl.
Yeah, thank you.
Your eyes look so disappointed in the gin palace when you're asking your hard questions, and I act like the answer is at the bottom of the glass I'm holding while you tell your version of events of the night we first met. Your hands on my face and my shaking leg, that's not love. I'm still that girl that you knew. That's not love. I'm still that girl that you knew. Bleached teeth, crow's feet, I'm underneath. Bleached teeth, crow's feet, I'm underneath. It's been so long since I last saw you. From my car across the street, you looked happy with your new girl, the way you were once with me. Hand on her bike, sharing coffee and silent history. That was us. I'm still that girl that you knew. That was us. I'm still that girl that you knew. Bleached teeth, crow's feet, I'm underneath. Bleached teeth, crow's feet, I'm underneath. I've never been further from you than I am now. I've never been further from you than I am now.
That girl, and that's Alva Reddy, who's performing for us live in studio here on Arena. Those kinds of songs, those intensely personal songs that are based in or around your life, do you find it cathartic when you write those songs? How do they affect you personally?
Well, you just write the most honest song that you can, and it starts off as this private thing, like you in your room writing a few bits and taking little notes, like scrappy like notes app stuff from your phone or little sheets of paper, and then you start putting it together in studio and all of the people that you're working with get to hear the lyrics for the first time. I find that really scary because they're people you know, so they can kind of figure out what it's about. And then you play it live at shows or whatever, and people project their own idea onto it, and then it becomes less and less yours and more everyone else's idea. Like there's so many songs I'm sure that you love and that I love where I don't really want to know what they wrote it about because I have my own idea about what it is. So that's the kind of best thing about music, I think, is hearing what other people feel when they hear it and hearing what they think it's about.
And in terms of that, sometimes do people talk to you about individual songs and they've projected something radically different onto the song that you never intended in the first place?
Yeah, it's so wild. I had a song years ago that someone thought was super religious and I was like, great for you, but that was a bad breakup. But yeah, it's wild what people project onto it. It's also like part of the shared kind of communal aspect to music, which is something that I've grown to believe in more and more as time has gone on. That's this thing to be shared. And it's about, it sounds cheesy, but like it's about trying to connect with other people through this alternate thing that isn't just conversation where you can kind of hide behind certain small talk. Instead, it's this thing that's to share that feels really pure.
Live performance sounds like it's something important to you, is it?
Yeah, I think it's super scary and can be so rewarding. At the same time, nothing worth doing is not scary, I suppose. So I still get super nervous before. But when you have a feeling in a room, you know, whether it's 20 people or 200 people or 2000 people, having that moment where you feel like everyone is just there sharing the same thing, it's pretty cool. There's nothing like it.
You're playing live guitar for us here tonight, but the new album, I've listened to it and it leans into a more electronic sound and a more electronic palette than you've worked with before. Talk to me a little bit about that change and that shift and why it happened.
Yeah, well, the first record was really bare bones. Second record was super indie guitar and I felt like I was pulling a lot from, you know, my peers. Like, I mean, Pillow Queens, dear friends of mine and also incredible musicians. And when it came to doing this album, a lot of it was demoing stuff that I was doing at home with like synths and mixing synths with acoustic guitars and acoustic drum kits along with electronic drum kits. And it just was this thing that I was kind of working away on for ages. And it became natural that it was this mix of organic sounds and electronic sounds. And also it was kind of part of that folk electronica era of music like David Gray and stuff that I would have listened to when I was in my teens. So it was kind of, it was less about listening to what was happening around me and more about listening to the things I grew up listening to.
Who else are your influences?
I mean, I love Julia Jacklin. I mean, Jeff Buckley was a massive influence on me as well. It's a huge, huge broad spectrum of things. I mean, one of my favorite musician when I was about 8 was Don McLean. So and he still is. American Pie, man.
You've described these songs for endings, almosts, and quiet beginnings. It's a really interesting set of phrases because we talk a lot about the big milestones, but maybe less so about those almost moments, those relationships or those moments that never quite happened or never quite solidified. Why is that, do you think?
I guess it's the bit that's interesting because when you're trying to write a song, I feel like you're stuck in the middle of a feeling. And when you write a song about what you're going through, it puts like a beginning, middle and end on it. It like figures out what the feeling is that you're getting through. There's been so many times I've been confused about something and I've sat down with a piano, guitar or whatever, or just noodling around on something. And by the end of it, maybe not straight away, but months later, I'll be like, God, I was really upset about this thing. It makes it obvious. It's this kind of form of therapy. I think that's why most songwriters write songs.
I was going to ask you that. That almost sounds like a form of personal therapy.
For sure. I think that's probably why I was always doing it. And you don't realize why you have this draw to, like, I mean, it sounds, it's obvious, right? Like, nobody's writing songs about the happy thing that happened to them in work that day. It's always about something kind of tricky because you're trying to transform this difficult thing into something, cathartic, something that means something to you.
Or those happy day at work songs. They're never really the ones people remember.
They're never really the ones people remember or relate to.
You signed with a record label in Philadelphia called Don Giovanni Records. Tell me about that. How did that come about?
So I'd been working with a UK kind of UK and New York based label on my last record. And coming out of that, I mean, there have been so many people involved. And I met Joe, who's the label head of Don Giovanni. And he was just a really good guy. Would come all the gigs. I felt like, why not release an album with somebody who, like, he's the head of a label, but I can text him or meet him for a beer or like ask him about stuff. And he's done some amazing stuff in his career and he's worked with some amazing artists and he just was immediately in on the album. And Philadelphia has a really cool indie music scene. And yeah, it just felt like the right move for me at the time.
Because there can be that situation when you've got, you know, you're signed to a label that's either medium-sized, big or whatever, that they have an awful lot of balls in the air at the same time and sometimes you can be slightly neglected.
Totally. I mean, I won't be the first artist to say that it can be a great move or a pretty spicy move, you know, working with 10 people, but you don't really know them that well and they're all there to do a job and it's your creative output into the world. It's your baby. Nobody can care as much as you do about it. So being able to have, I think more and more artists are realizing that having the power to figure out what you're doing, to work with the people that you want to work with, that is so powerful. And that's actually the only way to do it these days, I think.
I'm going to ask you to play something else from the album. How about Kiss Big?
Yeah, this is the title track.
I'm a last week in New York. You tip my glass and say, used to knowing you like I was dead. I like your eyes when they hide behind the lens. You bite your lips when you are concentrating. You own this world, but you're gentle with it. You own the room I just come to visit. Kiss me, sleep sweet. Think of me, kiss me, sleep sweet. Think of me, me. Ooh. Your voice dips in and out of the line. Jesus, billboards and the night sky. You're in a car to go and meet your friends. They say you miss me and the call ends. You own this swirl, but you're gentle with it. As a pauper, we share the minutes. Kiss, babe, sleep, sweet. Think of me. Kiss, babe, sleep, sweet. Think of me. The alarm and walk in the cold and wish we'd met forever ago and watch your bed, let you sleep and wait for you to move to me and he would not know what you say and wish I understood you anyway and talk.
Kiss Big, that is the title track from Alva Reddy's upcoming album. I saw you talking at one point about how much Ireland had changed since the marriage equality referendum and about how you now feel absolute freedom to use she in your lyrics, but that you hadn't always felt that.
Yeah, I think when I first started doing open mic nights around 2013, that was definitely something that you'd kind of gloss over a bit. And it's amazing now how there's so many queer acts out there and they feel free. It's not even a conversation topic. It's just this thing that people would never even question. And I think the amount of progress the country has made in that respect over the last decade and a bit is really incredible. I was asked about it. When you asked me about it, I'm just thinking like, it's not a topic that even comes up anymore. It's just something that people feel comfortable with and free to do. And that's pretty amazing.
Why do you think that's happened in music in general?
I think there's been more representation of some very brave queer artists early on, and then people like Wallace Bird and like that, like really paved the way for me, and a lot more, you know, women and queer people and non-binary people in the music industry who are being given opportunities, and a lot of people, you know, in radio and beyond, giving them opportunities is so important because once you see it, you feel like you can do it as well.
In terms of this album, you've been talking about you live in London at the moment and you've spent some time in New York and you're from Dublin. So with different songs being written in different places, does that change the vibe of those songs? And is it easier or hard then to kind of make them all work as a whole?
I think it's for me, because I suppose it's my life and it's also autobiographical. I didn't realize how much I was being influenced by that. Like that song was written half between New York and also while touring through America. And I mean, part of it is referring to driving through Indiana and seeing these billboards about, you know, Jesus loves you, those kind of American billboards that you see on the side of highways. And that I really noticed that is just this kind of cultural oddity, I suppose, to see things like that. So I suppose you're just always influenced by the people you're meeting, the music you're hearing, the films you're watching, books you're reading. I do feel like this album has a lot more in it because of that.
You're doing a Nullignamon show tomorrow. There's no point in us trying to plug it because it's sold out. You don't need to do that. But just tell us a little bit about it anyway.
It'd be beautiful. We're playing Ham Sandwich, who are an amazing band and good friends with Niamh for many years. And we've collaborated loads of times. So I think it'll be a lovely show. And it's in a church. So nice.
You're going to finish out by doing something else from the album.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Give us a third track. What are you going to go for? Untangling?
Untangling. Yeah. Great choice. A bit more up-tempo.
Yeah. think that once maybe I saw. Seems surreal that now you're a stranger. You seem different to I remember. Did you let your hair grow longer? Yeah, I think that I've moved on. How can I know where I've gone when the tiger lily feels more like coming undone. Are you still living in that old red brick with your friends, and do you like it? I guess it's none of my something inside me screaming out, it's all right.
Already, thanks for getting us first out of the traps on 2026 for Arena. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alva's new album, Kiss Big, is out on the 30th of January. Tickets for her headline gig at the Button Factory on May 8th are available from Ticketmaster.ie and from SingularArtists.ie. Here we go. You are listening to Monday Night's Arena. Known as the Painter of Light, J.M.W. Turner is considered to be one of the greatest landscape artists of all time. Channeling raw elemental forces, his atmospheric paintings illuminated the natural world and revolutionised British art of the time. Turner as Inspiration is an exhibition currently running at the National Gallery of Ireland, featuring a collection of his watercolours, which have recently been welcomed back following their loan to the National Galleries of Scotland. In this current exhibition, the paintings feature alongside the works of artists who've been inspired by this most influential of artists. Anne Hodge, curator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland, joins us this evening, and some of these pictures we'll be talking about are on the Arena Instagram at RTE underscore Arena. You go away for 2 weeks, you forget what the Instagram handle is. Anne, thank you for joining us tonight. For many art lovers, the Turner exhibit on in January in the National Gallery, it's almost like a national pilgrimage for them. It's been happening for 125 years, ever since the collection first came into the gallery in 1901. How did the gallery come to have this incredible collection?
It's amazing, really. There was a man, a London man called Henry Vaughan, and he loved art and he was very wealthy. And he spent his life collecting paintings and drawings, especially by Turner. And when he was making his will, he decided he was going to divide up his collection between the National Galleries in London, Dublin and Edinburgh. And he had no Irish connections at all, and he decided to give 31 of his really beautiful, fresh, bright watercolours by J.M.W. Turner, who was just this big name in British art then and now. And they all came to the gallery in a wonderful wooden box in 1900, and they were shown for the first time in 1901.
What is it about Turner that continues to be so compelling two centuries on, in your opinion, because there are lots of opinions, obviously.
Absolutely. I think it's because his work is so unusual in terms of, you know, what was happening when he was working. Art was quite conventional. There was a lot of beautiful, delicate watercolours of landscapes and so on. But he really wanted to bring landscape to the fore. He wanted to make landscape painting as important as history painting. So he, you know, drew trees and cliffs and water and so on, but in such a way that he got to grips with the feeling of nature. So when you look at a Turner watercolour, you get the sense of the spray jumping up from a waterfall, or the way the white caps on the waves appear. And it just looks real and yet not real also. It's not photographic. It's Turner-esque. So I think that's why he inspires people today. He inspires artists. People like the Impressionists loved his work. Someone like Mark Rothko, the famous American modernist painter, he loved Turner's work. And I think everyone, no matter whether you know anything about art or not, you can get something from a painting or drawing by Turner.
I'd love to try and figure out what Rothko took in his work from Turner. There's a line there that's fascinating. Tell me about that. I like that phrase, Turner-esque, because when you look at a painting or a watercolour of Turner's, it's almost immediately obvious that it's him, because despite the fact that he is doing something that other artists are doing and have been doing before him and afterwards, there is a real uniqueness to his work, isn't there?
Absolutely. And basically, he didn't care what anyone thought of his work. He just used whatever materials, whatever was to hand, to create an image and an impression and to capture and evoke nature and weather and so on. We have a beautiful, it's quite an early watercolour from 1802. It's from his first tour into Scotland. It's 1801. And it's a view looking across from Arthur's Seat, which is kind of a rocky area just outside the city, looking back towards Edinburgh. But in the distance, you can see this enormous rain cloud just coming over the city. And you can actually see the rain falling. You know, the way that those grey lines just come across the sky. And in the foreground, there's all these cows and they're just, you know, happily munching away. They're not aware that this big deluge is going to be on top of them in a few minutes. But Turner, at that point, very early in his career, he was doing something completely different from what other artists were doing. Other artists, you know, had quite, you know, neat, delicate work, but he was showing the weather. And it sounds a bit silly now because we're so familiar with expressionistic kind of works, but it was new at the time and he was reveling in it. He used his fingers, he used his thumbnail to scratch out some of the pigment to allow white highlights to come through. So he was a consummate artist and really did not care what anyone thought, so long as he could capture what he saw.
What do we know about Turner himself and his life?
We know quite a lot. There's an awful lot of people who've written about Turner. He was born in 1775. He came from a very kind of ordinary background. His father was a barber and a wig maker based in near Covent Garden in London. His mother came from a family of butchers. So, you know, they were business people. But Turner, from a very early age, had this artistic leaning, and his parents must have, you know, helped him out or encouraged him. And it's said that his father hung up when he was a child, the father hung up his young Turner's little daubs around the shop and sort of encouraged people to, I don't know whether to buy them, but to admire them, certainly. But then when he was 14, he went to the Royal Academy's schools. So they were drawing schools right in the centre of London. And he was recognised early on as being a real prodigy and being very, very talented. And in fact, he exhibited his first work at the Royal Academy, very prestigious exhibition when he was only 15. And from then on, his rise was, you know, we'd call it stellar. He was just brilliant. He opened his own a gallery in 1804, so very young, and he was a great businessman. He connected in with people who wanted to buy his work, so he made a lot of money. He was good at selling his work.
What did contemporary audiences make of his work? Did they understand what he was trying to do at the time?
That's a good question. And I think some did and some didn't. There was a lot of critics of his work, particularly when he became very expressive towards the end of his career. For instance, there's an amazing painting called Snowstorm at Harbour's Mouth. So it's a big oil painting. It's not in the National Gallery of Ireland. It's in Tate in London. And in that, he painted this storm, literally a ship labouring in a huge storm. It's like a sort of a whirlpool of movement. It's a bit like looking into a washing machine or something like that. And at the time, they were horrified. They thought it was unfinished. They thought it was ugly. One critic in the newspaper said, soap suds and whitewash, you know, that's all it is. And Turner was kind of very upset at that, the fact that they didn't understand. And he said that I am trying to show what it is like to be in a storm. And the apocryphal story is that he actually asked some sailors on a sailing ship to literally lash him to the mast. And he spent 4 hours, you know, in a storm, absorbing the experience. And then he said, if I survive, I am going to paint this. And so he did.
If he was an actor, you'd call that method. people might be familiar with Turner in general, but in terms of the Turner collection at the National Gallery of Ireland, remind us what's in it.
So it came to us in 1900, from Henry Vaughan, this English collector. It was put on for the first time in the gallery in 1901. And it's been shown ever since. So there are 31 watercolours in the collection. And what's really interesting about them, or what I love, is the fact that it covers the whole of Turner's career. So there are works that he did when he was 19, literally, right up to the 1840s, when he was in his 60s. And art was his life, literally. I mean, that sometimes sounds like a cliche, but it was true in his case. So, for instance, you have a very early work, the Westgate Canterbury. Beautiful watercolour, very detailed. You have the big Norman towers of the gate in the background. But in the foreground, he has this little lean-to, a shack, basically. And there's a man just leaning against. It's obviously a slow day. He seems to be a knife grinder or something. He's having a slow day. And Turner has captured that detail. And it just shows how much he loved to, within, you know, a very beautiful watercolour, include very ordinary aspects of life. And I think that's another reason why we can connect with it today, because it's very human. And in the background of that particular watercolour is a lovely little, it's just a carriage with a man going across, bumping along the cobbles into the, you know, into the city. So there's amazing detail.
In terms of his travels, there are paintings obviously from across England, there are paintings in Scotland. He didn't really paint Ireland at all. But I understand one of the reasons why he travelled very extensively in the UK, certainly for some of his career, was because Europe was basically closed because of ongoing wars that were happening all across the continent.
That's right. The Napoleonic Wars basically shut England, Britain off from the rest of Europe for many, many years. Now, there was a gap when the Treaty of Amiens was announced. That was in 1802. And literally, Turner hot-footed it straight across the channel into Switzerland. He was just so excited to be in the Alps. And we have an amazing watercolour in the collection called the Falls of the Reichenbach. So that's one of those really dramatic alpine waterfalls. And Turner literally made hundreds of sketches while he was there. And the watercolour we have is a slightly more finished one, very expressive. You can even see his thumbprint where he's just putting down the paint very quickly to give that sense of flowing water, you know, in a torrent coming down. Yeah, so Switzerland, he was there in 1802. Then Europe shut down again. The Napoleonic Wars took off again. And it wasn't until 1819 that he actually got back into Europe. And at that point, he went to Italy. That's where he wanted to see Rome. Most artists found Rome just so exciting and so inspirational. And he went there too.
Does the exhibition change every year?
Yes and no. So every year we show the 31 watercolours from the Vaughan bequest. And we have to do that because Henry Vaughan stipulated that they must be shown in January only. The reason for that was because the light, as we all know, in these dark days, it's at its lowest level. So it's less damaging to the works. And that that whole thing is because in Victorian times, galleries had windows, so the sunlight was coming in and it would have faded the watercolours. Henry Vaughan was aware of that. He wanted to prevent that from happening into the future. And he said in his will, they should only be shown in January. They should always be shown all together in a group, and they should always be free of charge. So we will never, ever charge anyone to see these incredible watercolours. Yeah, and it just happens every single year. But every year we do try and mix it up a little bit, if you like, or add something different. One year I had an exhibition and I called it The Business of Being Turner, because he was a great businessman. And in 2018, we had work by Neil Nassens. And then this year, I have I've put in a collection of 13 works by artists who were inspired by Turner, and they're artists who worked in the 19th century right up to today. And there's a really gorgeous work by Jennifer Lane, a printmaker who works with Graphic Studio Dublin. And it's called Homage to Turner, because she was really, she wanted to sort of channel his energy and how he looked at landscape. And that's there. There are also works by Neil Nassens, who, as I said, in 2018 made a whole body of work in response to Turner's work. And so we have some of his work there, prints and drawings. And Neil is based in West Kerry. But one of the works we have is Cathair Conry and A Shower of Hail. Now, it's not, you know, you look at it and you go, what's that to do with Turner? But it's both of them looking at weather and how it comes in over the different landscapes. Venice, maybe in Turner's case, West Kerry in Neil's case. And then there's other 19th century artists. We've a great work by, I love his name, Hercules Brabazon. And he just loved going to the same places that Turner went to and sort of making even more expressionistic works. So there are 13 other works by artists that just loved what Turner had done.
And in terms of how you exhibit it every year, do you start with a blank sheet as curator? So for next year, for 2027,
oh gosh,
I don't want to put the fear of God in you, but you're already starting to think about what might potentially make up next year's collection and what you'll do with it.
Absolutely. We all, because many people come again and again to see our Turner watercolours, and they would be happy, I'm sure, most of them, just to see the Turners, because they are incredible and they really do merit looking closely, because they're quite small. So you need to kind of go nose up against the glass of the case, maybe, to really see the brush strokes and sometimes the hand, the fingerprints and so on. And yet, you know, people who do come every year, we like to do something a bit different. So yeah, we do add in different things or change the theme and put the focus maybe on the maritime works, or often we'd put in some prints. Turner made a wonderful collection of prints called the Liber Studiorum, and we have a whole set of 71, so sometimes we show some of those as well.
Within that collection, he did manage to make it to Italy, so you do have some of those later works, some of those that capture scenes during his trip to Venice.
Yeah, well, there's one in particular. My favourite Venetian scene from our collection is called Storm at the Mouth of the Grand Canal, and it dates to 1840. So we're at the towards the end of his life and career, but he's still so excited by the light and the water of Venice. And this image, you know, and if I can describe it, it's so it's again another storm scene, and you have a big dark purpley grey blue cloud coming in over the city. And I'm sure sometimes you see, if there's a storm coming but there's bright sunlight, and then things like, you know, buildings or maybe tree trunks just shine white in this kind of slightly otherworldly light. And he has captured that exactly, because that big tower in the Piazzetta in Venice, he shows it literally shining out white. And then in the distance, you can see another church and it's glowing red. And then in the foreground, you can see it's just very few simple little lines of watercolour, but it's a gondolier, and you can see he's stretching to just get his gondola into dry land before the storm hits. So he's working hard, and that is shown in just a few very simple brushstrokes. And I think that's part of Turner's genius, you know, evoking these things. And if you go to Venice, if you're lucky enough to go sometime, you will see the light that Turner manages to capture in paint.
I'm sitting at the far side of the desk from you, and you have your catalogue in front of you. And even I can see that unique use of Turner's gold, that colour that he manages to almost insert into everything that he does. And it's hugely present in that picture.
There's a wonderful golden light in that particular watercolour, you're right. But also he was known for using yellow, and often he was criticised for yellow. And there was lots of new yellows on the market when he was working, and he would use these chrome yellows and different colours. And people found that a little bit, it was a bit edgy, it was a bit bright, but he made it work, I think.
Thank you to Ruth for texting us and saying that his watercolour Reichenbach Falls is where Sherlock Holmes tussles with his arch enemy Moriarty. I was going to go into a whole digression about that and I didn't. And thank you to Anne, who just says, I go to the Turner exhibition every year. It's wonderful. It is always new, thanks to the National Gallery. That's Anne, who's in Dublin 13. Anne Hodge, curator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland. Thanks for joining us this evening on Arena.
Thank you, Rick.
Turner as Inspiration is an exhibition of watercolours featuring alongside the work of artists who are inspired by the great landscape painter. It runs strictly for the month of January and admission is free. There's a rich programme of talks and events planned for January 2, offering visitors the opportunity to explore the themes and artistic techniques in Turner's works. For more details, you can find all of that at www.nationalgallery.ie. First fortnight, Ireland's annual Mental Health, Arts and Culture Festival celebrates Nollaig na mBan tomorrow evening at Whelan's in the company of musician Tallulah McKay and two poets, Jan Brereton and Vona Gruach. Jan began writing poetry in 2021. Her poem, What Day Is It? Who Gives an Expletive Deleted? I'm not doing that on Arena tonight. Was a howl of frustration against the sameness of life during lockdown, and it went viral on the internet. It gave her the title for her first poetry collection, also published in 2021. Jan published a second book last year, Everybody is a Poem, Midlife in Rhyme, in Rhymes. And I'm delighted that Jan joins me now in studio.
Oh, lovely to see you.
You're describing tomorrow's event as a hooli. It's a mix of music and it's a mix of poetry. So what should people expect?
Yeah, a hooli, yeah, a mix of music and poetry. It's a safe space for us all to kind of share, you know, I suppose our womanly woes on Women's Christmas. I'll be reading from my two books. I know Vrona will be reading some of her poetry and Tallulah will be singing and maybe giving us a little dance as well, because, you know, she's in Dancing with the Stars too. But yeah, it's going to be just a gorgeous kind of warm evening for all the girls. The guys are invited as well if they like.
You're going to start off by reading something for us. I think you're going to start with But.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? It's kind of perfect, this one, because I wrote this one, you know, when I was feeling particularly low myself. I suppose that's the whole point of the festival, you know, that, again, it kind of creates a safe space for, you know, us to communicate, I suppose, our mental ill health through the arts. So I wrote this. Yeah, listen, you'll figure it out, Rick, once I get through it. So it's called But. The woman in me is exhausted. The chef in me is out on strike. The teacher in me has nothing to teach, and the mother in me is in strife. The housekeeper in me is dog tired. The worker in me is off sick. The student in me isn't listening, and the wife in me thinks he's a dick. The peacemaker in me can't say sorry. The friend in me, nothing to give. The daughter in me pleads, don't worry, and the forgetter in me won't forgive. The supporter in me has no chance left. The juggler in me dropped the ball. The reader in me can't finish a book, and the caller in me missed the call. The cleaner in me threw the towel in. The fashionista in me looks like crap. The beauty in me feels more like a beast, and the gym bunny in me needs a nap. The talker in me has gone silent. The carer in me could care less. The spender in me is insolvent, and the organiser in me is a mess. But the sharer in me is still sharing. The thinker in me is still deep. The lover in me still has something to give, and the dreamer in me is not asleep.
Remind us of the lockdown collection and how that came about.
Oh, yeah. So I felt not unlike how I felt when I wrote that poem there, but it was 2021. I was tired, exhausted, like, you know, like we all were. I was worn out. I was sick of going to the park, and I had this internal kind of dialogue with lots of swearing. Rick, I swear a lot and I do it in my head. And for some reason, it came down onto paper. It rhymed. I typed it out and I sent it to a few of the mammies from school because I figured, well, they're going to probably be feeling the same way that I am. And actually, Roisin Ingalls, her two girls were in my daughter's class at the time. So she was kind of one of the mammies from the group. And she asked, could she share it on her Twitter? Because I wasn't on Twitter. I'm still not on it. Like, it's just too scary. And once she shared it, we just got this incredible, you know, kind of feedback. And I was getting messages from people in Australia and I had a message from people in India saying, you know, yeah, I feel exactly the same way as you. And then from that, I just kept writing and I couldn't stop. And the first book came shortly after that. And then from that came the performance. And that's been, you know, the most kind of exciting kind of thing for me, you know, in the last couple of years, because it's all new to me. That was 2021. So I still feel like a newbie.
You say you write as a woman of a certain age with two kids and a cat and a husband.
Yeah.
What does the tradition of Nollaig na mBan mean to you, if anything?
Well, a celebration of all the little and marvellous things that us women do. You know, I think I actually have a poem called Multitask, and I'll be reading that tomorrow at the event in Whelan's. But, you know, that's where I celebrate all the small little things that we find ourselves doing. Like the first line of it is, you know, I clean my teeth on the loo to save time. You know, it's just like sometimes I go, aren't I just brilliant that I can do all those things at once? So, yeah, Nollaig na mBan, it's an opportunity for me to celebrate all of the small things that us women do together and for us to kind of uplift each other as well, you know, and just to have one last little hooly before the end of January.
You worked in fashion. You were a stylist before you started to write and before all of that happened. So does a lot of your inspiration for your writing, does it come from the visual?
Yeah, I am a very visual person. Yeah, I've worked in fashion all my life and I still do. And part of actually the whole poetry and the performance thing that I really enjoy is actually kind of getting dressed up. So that's some of my fashion kind of element in there. But yeah, I am a very visual person. I'll find that I'll take inspiration from things that I see. You know, if I'm in like the supermarket or if I'm on the bus or if I see how a couple look at each other, maybe, you know, in a bar, that will kind of start something off for me. You know, and I like to express myself, you know, kind of with how I present as well. So, yeah, I'm a real pictures person. I mean, I didn't for a minute think that words were a way for me to express myself. But turns out, you know, I speak plainly, I write plainly and I write about stuff that, you know, I know.
I'd like you to read something else for us. Maybe hope is in the dark because, you know, it's the 5th of January and maybe this is a great time of the year for people needing something like this.
Yeah. And this is just, again, this was, you know, feeling rubbish, but kind of realising that when I can acknowledge that I'm feeling rubbish, there's a little bit of hope there. You know, that's where the light comes in. So hope is in the dark. Beneath the layers of pain, there is hope. On the darkest of days, there is hope. When you're out of your heart, there is hope. And as things fall apart, there is hope. In your wine and your nuts, there is hope. In the space between us, there is hope. In the kitchen, not dressed, dancing alone like a dope, there's hope. That is hope. In the bad and the good, there is hope. In the could, would and should, there is hope. And today, when you think I can't cope, tomorrow is hope. There is hope.
You're going to be touring again this year. You've got some very nice gigs lined up for 2026.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Like all the live stuff has been amazing. I am touring with a man called Henry Normal. He's a British poet in April around the UK and I'll bring him here to Ireland as well. And he comes from Tellyland. He wrote with Carolyn Ahern, Steve Coogan. He wrote on Gavin and Stacey. He's an amazing poet. So I'll be touring around the UK with him. And maybe I'll bring him in to see us here when he comes to Ireland. And then in September, I am opening up for my hero, John Cooper Clarke, in the Olympia. And I'll be doing Belfast Mandela Hall with him as well.
You've already supported him before, haven't you? What was that like?
That was like a dream come true. Like it really, really was. I supported him in the Olympia a couple of years ago. And then last year, I supported him in the London Palladium and in the Manchester Arena. He was the first poet to read in an arena. So does that make me the first Irish female poet to read in an arena, let's say.
If you were supporting him, you went on before him technically, so that might make
you... Oh, maybe it was me. Yeah, maybe. But yeah, no, that, I mean, like, that's just been extraordinary. And he's such, you know, he's actually such an inspiration. Like that, I'm a woman of a certain age and, you know, John is, you know, a man of a particular vintage as well, and he's still going and he's still touring, he's still writing amazing poetry. So, you know, he's a real inspiration for me to keep going.
It's been great to talk to you tonight, and best of luck with the event tomorrow night and with the tour and everything else going along for the year. Jan Burton, thanks for coming into Arena. Jan Burton's at Whelan's tomorrow evening, the 6th of January, for Nollaig na mBan with Tallulah McKay and Ireland Professor of Poetry Fiona Gruark as part of the First Fortnight Festival. More details at firstfortnight.ie. And that is it for the very first show of 2026 here on Arena. Tonight's show produced by Sian O'Gorman, researched by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was our broadcast coordinator, and Cara O'Hare was on sound supervision. Tomorrow night, I'm talking to Olivia Lang about her novel, The Silver Book. Pat Carty will be discussing the new David Bowie book, Lazarus, The Second Coming of David Bowie. And we'll find out a bit more about He Dies in the End, a new play that's also part of First Fortnight as well. Fíochna O'Brien is in for John Creedon. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7.